to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fedris.
And we are pleased to be joined today with Edward Penton, although we wish it were on a less tragic topic. Today we are talking about the tragic news out of the UK, the apparent murder of Anne Widdecombe, a faithful Catholic and a high-profile British politician. So, Edward, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley. Good to be with you both.
When the news first broke that she had died at age 78, it was shocking to be sure, but we were initially told the news stories made it seem like there was no foul play. I think the first story I read suggested that there was some kind of a fall. But since then, it turned into first the story was that it was a murder, and then it changed into a framing of being a terrorist incident. Edward, can you shed a little bit more light on what you know about the actual cause of the death of this incredible woman?
Sure. Yes. Well, you're exactly right. It was originally considered to be, I was told it was possibly a fall. I was actually given a little bit of advance notice because I know a friend of hers who told me this. And I was also told that the police were from the beginning trying to rule out any criminal element to it. And so that was early on, that was a consideration. And then later on, within a few hours, we got the confirmation that it was in fact a murder investigation and it was a killing. And so that's how we came to know it. And what seems to have happened is that somebody broke into the house, it sounds like, and attacked her and killed her there in her house, which has been a great concern to many people because it shows that, you know, if it is also a targeted killing, which is what's being said, probably because of her political views, then it's even more concerning and disturbing that somebody, a politician, can be attacked in their own home. And so former politician, she's not even an MP, hasn't been an MP since 2010, although she was a member of the European Parliament for a short time. And so all of these are very concerning to a lot of people, of course, especially to the party to which she belonged as an associate, as a member, which is the Reform Party, which is a conservative party within the UK, very Eurosceptic. And she was a member of that. And so her colleagues in that party are, of course, also very concerned about their own safety, too. So the whole thing is very concerning. It's deeply tragic and a great loss, as Anne Widdecombe was considered a great stalwart for principle. She was one of the last principled politicians who really was a politician who lived by her principles, and especially her Catholic faith. Her Catholic faith was central to her and governed a lot of what she did in the politics and her views on politics. And so it's a great, great loss.
Well, we certainly want to delve into her legacy, but just one more follow-up question on the crime itself. Can you explain to us Americans what would be the difference between a murder investigation and a terrorist investigation? And in the United States, we think of terrorism as like somebody, you know, detonating a bomb in a market, not usually one single targeted attack. So what would be the distinction with that classification if it was a murder?
Yes, it's a good question. I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's the terrorist aspect to it has been ruled out. It has been called a targeted attack, but not a terrorist attack so far. And I think probably because they don't see it as a kind of perhaps an Islamist attack or something like that. I think what they consider it to be is a politically motivated attack, possibly.
Okay.
They haven't said that for sure. So it's likely to be because of her politics rather than any kind of terrorist element to it.
Edward, can you give us a little sense of the trajectory of her life in politics, including her conversion? And do you think that that would make someone despise her so much that they would create this act just based on her faith? Because Jacob Rees-Mogg is calling her a martyr for the faith.
Yes, I mean, this is something that's starting to be discussed, and with good reason, because she was brought up an Anglican. In fact, many of her family were Anglicans. Her uncle was an Anglican vicar. Her nephew, her brother was an Anglican canon. And she was, when she was received into the church in 1993, it was because over women priests, but she said it was really because that was one of the final straws for her. But the key element was that the Anglican Church, the Church of England, was going too much with the times. It was trying to be relevant and becoming very lost, really, in its doctrine, and she couldn't abide by that. She wanted to join the Catholic faith because of the church's teaching, and that the church's teaching doesn't compromise. And she was great, she held to that very much. And I think, as I said earlier, I think it really did govern her politics. I think she believed very deeply in the church's teaching. She followed it very closely. She stood up publicly for all of the neuralgic topics, which often do spark animosity, and as we're called to do as Catholics, is to go countercultural. Well, she certainly did that. She stood up against same-sex marriage. She stood up constantly against abortion, and all of these topics. She was very pro-life, and so these things sort of brought her, really made her a target, if you like, for those elements of society which can be very vicious and violent when you do stand up for these topics. And I think you could argue with that case that perhaps there was a sort of diabolical reaction to the things she would stand up for, and the good elements, obviously the truths of the church's teaching, which she stood up for, which drew this sort of vitriolic, diabolical attack. I think we've seen it before. I mean, there was a similar case in Ireland not long ago, which had a very similar sort of diabolical reaction. Now, it was perhaps jumping the gun a bit here, but it doesn't seem like it doesn't look like at all like a sort of failed burglary attempt. It looks like something much, much more serious than that. And as they say, the police are looking at it as a targeted attack. So I think you could argue in that sense that her faith informed her politics in such a state, such a way that you could argue that there is a sort of element of martyrdom here. But that would be very interesting if that sort of element was developed further, and we saw that, and it's confirmed as well. So we'll have to see, but it does certainly, there is that element to it, I think.
Well, you wrote in a Substack post, going back to her conversion. I love this. She said, "Converting to Catholicism, the ordination of women was the final straw of, quote, a very large bundle." I love that. But on this topic, you also mentioned that she was a close friend of Sir David Amess, who was a Catholic conservative MP. And I remember where I was when I read the news of his violent death, also a targeted attack. In that case, it was by an Islamist. But do you think she had a sense that she was targeted, or maybe being targeted?
I think she may have done, but she was such a doughty lady. She wouldn't have worried about it at all. And I think, she was very courageous. She was very, she was nothing was going to stop her from speaking up and speaking out on these issues. And so, this is what made her so great, and which I think, she, it's as I say, it's going to be a great loss. But there are some very interesting similarities with Sir David Amess, who, she knew very well. She was godmother to one of his children, in fact, I got a comment from her when he was killed, because I knew that she was very close to him, and they were both very, very good, stalwart, strong Catholics. Sir David was a member of the All Parliamentary Group on the Holy See, and he took a great interest in Britain's relations with the Holy See. And they both took their Catholic faith very seriously. And so it is interesting that they both died in these tragic circumstances, and probably because their faith, as I say, informed their politics to such an extent.
Here in the US, yesterday, two Supreme Court justices testified on behalf of raising the budget for their security. And they told some pretty harrowing stories, including having to have a bulletproof vest and getting swatted outside their house where somebody makes a claim of illegal activity going on in their home. So, do you feel like the stakes are a lot higher in terms of security worries and risks for conservatives in England versus liberals?
Yes, I do. I think it does seem to be that the more the really violent reactions come from the left, as it were. I mean, we've seen it time and again. I mean, obviously, it's not exclusively so. There was a Labour politician who was killed. I can't remember her name. I think it was Cox, who she was sadly tragically killed as well. And she was. That was from somebody on the right. So it's not exclusively so, but it does seem to be concentrated on with from the left. And so so that is also a concern. And what this also I think is also concerning for many people is that anyone who's wanting to go into public life, especially if they're going to stand up for these issues, is going to possibly be put off now. So you've got you're going to have a dearth of good principled politicians who won't necessarily want to put themselves in the front line, especially if they have a family or, you know, dependents and so forth. So it's a pretty devastating blow to democracy in this country, I would say.
I've thought a lot about that in the wake of the assassination of Charlie Kirk, that similarly, he was so courageous, and I don't think anybody ever really thought that what happened to him could have happened, but it did. And it certainly chills, it has a chilling effect, because who wants to stand up for these values if that's your reward? And one of the things that she was so courageous in speaking out about, especially as the currents continued to change against her, was the sanctity of human life. And I found it interesting that she really was emphatic about the fact that her beliefs on this were certainly informed by her faith, but that those views were rooted in not just in faith, but in deep ethical beliefs that you don't have to be Catholic to share. Can you talk a little bit about her pro-life witness in the UK?
Yes, I mean, she was not afraid, as I say, to speak up. I don't know what particular groups she belonged to, but she certainly would always be happy to speak up against that. She also, you know, spoke up against things like sort of radical feminism or feminism that she felt had gone too far, and these issues which, you know, are controversial. She said her colleagues considered her rather odd because she would stand up for these unfashionable these unfashionable positions. But you know, she, as I say, she was very happy to do that. And but the other thing is, you know, as the faith is important because I think that gave her the strength and the courage to do this. And unfortunately, fewer people now, you know, have the Catholic faith. They don't have the faith necessarily that she had that would make her courageous enough to basically lay down her life for her principles and her faith and her beliefs. And so that again is another aspect which doesn't augur well for the future, let's say, because again you're going to get fewer and fewer people coming into politics who are going to be willing to really stand up for their faith even to such an extent, I think.
She really wanted to stress that she wanted to see a free Britain where citizens can express themselves freely as long as they don't incite violence. And what a marvelous clip of her giving the speech at the Oxford Union. I mean, that was just an incredible witness to both the melding of what she thought about free speech, but you felt the undercurrent that there was also, she was fighting for freedom to for religion as well.
Yes.
How much do you see free speech eroding, and how does that specifically impact Catholics whose beliefs go against so many of the teachings that are, excuse me, they go against so many of the laws that are being, passed in England?
Yeah, well, this is very interesting, Betsy, because this has become a very topical point here, topical story, because the government is sort of cracking down on people who are just going to comment on social media. So there's an element of real concern about the restrictions on free speech. And as you say, she was very strong on that, and consistently so, and over a long period of time. In fact, Cardinal Nichols, which I might which I'll probably put up later today, has issued a statement to an organization to which Anne Widdecombe was a member, and he pointed out that she was not afraid. He said that fear or timidity is often the enemy of freedom, but in her, freedom won over fear every time. She was ready to say what she held to be true, and she was free to grant to others the freedom to say in their turn what they thought. And so for her, freedom, not just in speech, but I think in so many things, was key to her understanding and her faith and her politics. She didn't, although she was quite forceful and redoubtable, and she didn't hold back in putting her views across. She always left people free. You didn't have to believe what she said, but she put them across powerfully and strongly. But she still gave people the freedom to believe whatever they wanted to believe. Which of course is what our faith demands, that we're not to impose our faith on others, but to present it. And so I think there again, you see, I think she stood by that, and I think it led to, unfortunately, the what happened to her, I think.
There was a tweet that Charlie Kirk had put out maybe 10 years before he was killed that people dug up and recirculated, something to the effect of you can kill a name, but you can't kill the man or something. No, you can kill the man, but you can't kill the name. My point being, there's no question that she's mortally dead, but her legacy will live on and undoubtedly will inspire, as more people read about her, people to stand up for their beliefs and maybe even convert to Catholicism. And, in the United States, there's been so many articles about these waves of converts coming into the church. And there's been some negative Nellies saying, oh, well, the numbers are actually down. But the reality is, maybe some people are leaving the church, but the people who are joining the church have a real zeal that is authentic. Are you seeing any of this happen in the UK, and do you think that assassination, whatever we end up calling it, will kind of continue to kindle that kind of interest and fervor for the faith?
Yes, I think it will actually, and there is certainly a sort of revival going on here too, and it's mostly among young men, interestingly. I think they're drawn particularly to, and they're drawn also particularly to the sort of traditional aspects of the faith, which Anne was too. And so I think, I think you're going to see more of that. And of course, it's because she was willing to sacrifice herself in so many ways, not just in the, laying down her life in the end, but I think in so many different ways that it shows the reality of the faith to, and the authenticity of the faith for many people, and especially to young people who are looking for that authenticity. And so, yes, I do think it will have that effect. And of course, the martyrs are the seeds of the church. And so, I think if she were to be declared a martyr, then certainly that would be a very strong element in increasing people coming to the church, as I say, probably young people, I think.
Well, it's amazing that 2,000 years later, it's still true that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the truth. And sometimes I think about just the constancy of that. Even that alone is should intrigue people about the Catholic faith. But Edward, thank you so much for joining us today. I wish it were on a happier topic, but it's an important tragedy that merits our attention. To catch all of his writings, check out the National Catholic Register at ncregister.com and make sure to subscribe to his new Substack. Thank you, Edward, so much for joining us today.
Thank you both. Good to be with you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio, where I am joined by TCA resident chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry.
Great to be with you, Betsy, as always.
This week, there's a great American saint that we have on our calendar. Can you talk to us about the first Native American saint ever?
Thanks, Betsy. Yes, earlier this Tuesday, we had the great joy on the 14th to celebrate the feast of Saint Kateri Tekakwitha, the Lily of the Mohawks, the first person born in the area that is now the United States to be raised to the altar. She died in 1680 at the tender age of 24, after only really 4 years as a Catholic. And in some circles, she's considered a little bit of a politically correct saint because people thought that the reason why she was beatified was not because of her intrinsic holiness and the fact that she's a model and an intercessor for us, but simply by the fact that she was a Native American at a time in which some people wanted to just include people of every sort of background. Some, kind of like they do the same thing to Saint Francis of Assisi, want to look at her as a patron of ecology and things because of Native Americans' love for nature and a real gratitude to God for the material world. She's a saint because she's holy, and her story teaches us a lot. She was born in Auriesville, New York, at the property of the Shrine of the North American Martyrs in 1656, only a decade after St. Isaac Joke and St. Jean de la Lande fertilized the soil where she was born with their own martyrial blood, and only 14 years after St. René Goupil died in that very place. And so she grew up surrounded by the stories of these three great missionary martyrs of the Jesuits, three of the eight North American martyrs. She almost lost her life when she was four. Her parents both died of smallpox. Her brother died of smallpox. And she went blind basically because of smallpox. She was called Tekakwitha in the Mohawk dialect because it means she was always bumping into things. She really couldn't see, so she was bumping into you, she was bumping into trees. But she was always filled with a desire to find out and do what was most pleasing to God. So she was asking everybody, who can show me how I can be most pleasing to God? And eventually, the Jesuits returned to Auriesville, which is a sign of incredible heroism. And Father Jacques de Lamberville was there, and she approached Father de Lamberville and just asked him that question. And so we began to instruct her in the faith. It was always a risk to baptize a Mohawk because the pressure to revert was super high and was even worse for women because everything worked through women in the Mohawk culture. When she married, whoever she married became part of her family, and whatever he hunted and caught, whatever he fished and caught, became a property of her family. And so she was going to become the first consecrated virgin in North American history. She wasn't going to be able to bring some valiant Mohawk into her own family line. And so, in addition to the fact that she didn't have her parents around and her uncle really didn't understand why she was attracted to Christianity, it was going to be worse for her. And so, a year after she was finally baptized, when Father de Lamberville realized she was solid in the faith and she had the character that she'd be able to remain faithful, they had to get her out of there because her life was at risk. And they sent her up to their mission of Saint Francis Xavier in Kanawaka, just south of what's now Montreal. And there, every day while they were in that mission, she would get up an hour before the church would open, even in the middle of the brutal Canadian winters, and do a holy hour outside the window of the chapel of St. Francis Xavier, looking at the tabernacle lamp burning through that clear window. When the church opened, she'd do a holy hour inside the church, attend a mass, go out, work all day, just like the hardworking Native Americans always did, and then come back at the end of that brutal day of work and do a holy, attend a second mass, do another holy hour inside, do another holy hour outside in the cold, and then finally return and spend the time with her family. I like to say that she's the patron saint of Eucharistic adoration because she just knew that that was the Lord Jesus. She wanted to maximize the time with him. And in those time periods where all of the Mohawks would go on the road during the summer, for example, to do hunting, and she wasn't close to the chapel, she would take a crucifix, she'd put it in the knot of a tree, and she'd spend that same amount of time just adoring Christ in his exaltation on the cross for us and our salvation, a couple hours every day. So, just a beautiful saint of prayer, a beautiful saint who teaches us how to prioritize doing what's most pleasing to God, a great fruit of the work of the missionary martyrs and the North American martyrs, and just one of the greatest Americans who's ever lived. And we will recognize, as we celebrate this 250th anniversary, that she died almost 100 years before our country was founded. And it was because of her prayers, I think, that our country got off to the start it did.
Thank you for that great explanation of a great American saint. What was the long-term effect of her conversion on the Mohawk Nation?
So it was a contradiction on many of the Mohawks. She wasn't the only Mohawk convert. There were others who were great Mohawk saints. But over the course of time, everybody told her story. Everybody knew that, like, she totally lived out as a Mohawk what the integration of sort of Mohawk good habits were with Christianity. And so she was always a light. Since the time of her beatification, when she was lifted up by the church as a real model, she has likewise become a great hero for the Mohawks. They're often pilgrimages up to Auriesville, New York, where she was born. And then only 7 miles away is the shrine where she would have made her first Holy Communion. Likewise, many go up to Kanawaka in Canada in order to be able to pray at her tomb there at the Church of St. Francis Xavier. Because the Native Americans, whether they're Mohawks or of any other tribe, have suffered over the course of the history of our country and sometimes suffered with at least the material complicity of the church. Like, for example, in those crazy periods in which kids were ripped out of their homes in order to be able to give them an education off the reservation and stuff. A lot of the times that was done in church institutions. It was the government ripping them away, but it was the church that was educating. Sometimes they can have a complicated relationship with the Catholic Church. Likewise, when you go back to some of the decrees at the Age of Discovery, where the popes were trying to limit the human rights abuses that were happening against Native Americans everywhere. So sometimes they can have a mixed bag relationship with Christianity in general, as well as the Catholic Church in particular. St. Kateri Tekakwitha shows them what can happen when someone receives the faith as a gift and begins to be nourished in that faith of the church. She went from Native American unbeliever to a beatified and a canonized saint in just 4 years of time of her life on earth, which shows what baptism and Eucharistic adoration and regular reception of Holy Communion can do in people just like us.
Thank you so much, Monsignor Landry.
Great to be with you once again, Betsy.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we have the one and only Amy Wellborn on the show with us today, the author of more than 20 books on Catholic spirituality, apologetics, and history, including the best-selling Great Adventure, Kids Catholic Bible Chronicles, published by Ascension. Amy holds a bachelor's degree in history from the University of Tennessee and a master's in church history from Vanderbilt University. And Amy has 5 children. Thank you, Amy, for making time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amy, you definitely have a big presence on Twitter, and you wax on a lot of interesting topics. Most recently, one on the Atlantic cover article about the so-called death of reading, which is a shockingly sad thought, but you had a little bit of a different take. But I wanted to start with saying how much I loved the photo that you used in your post on it. It was a picture, I believe, of you as an 8-year-old discovered in a bathtub with no water in it, reading a book. And I saw that and laughed because it made me think of my own childhood, which was a childhood that was defined by reading. And I would find the weirdest nooks. Sometimes I would try to hide my reading because I was reading past bedtime. I would devise these elaborate ways to prop my books up so I could eat and read at the same time. And it does feel like a little bit of a bygone era in our world of screens. But what was your initial reaction to reading that story about the Atlantic article?
Well, it's of course not the first time someone has sounded this alarm, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, ever since the invention of any kind of electronic media, people have been concerned about that, about reading, concerns about literacy, concerns about what people are reading, which is maybe something we'll come back to. And I think that There is one level in which the concern is absolutely justified. And anybody who's in a classroom, anybody who's teaching any level from kindergarten to college would share this concern and would express their direct experience of this problem. But at the same time, I think that part of the article's problem was that it was a little narrow in its envision of what reading is or what should count, that the fact that people aren't reading quote literary fiction means that reading is on the way down. Well, I mean, that is kind of goes to a what we might call a survivor bias when you look at past eras. In past eras, not everybody was sitting around reading Faulkner, even Dickens, right? They were reading, but they were reading just as trashy stuff as people are reading now. And so I think there's a yes and no about that concern. I think absolutely there is a concern about r justifiable concern about reading and about retention and attention span, which I think is something many of us share, even for our own selves, something that we've noticed. The ability to engage in a long form narrative and follow it and retain it and then discuss it. That's problematic. That I think that is a skill that is definitely decreasing. But are people just not reading? That's not true. In fact, if you look at it, if you consider it, our relationship to screens, we're watching a lot of video, but we're also kind of reading all day, right? And writing all day. And I think that, my anecdotal experience does not indicate that reading is dying. And by that, I don't mean my own personal engagement with literature. I mean what I see and what I observe in libraries, bookstores, among other people, book clubs, and all of that kind of thing. So it's definitely a mixed bag.
You have been a teacher, children's author, you're a mother, you're a grandmother. Do you see children, and maybe your children probably are more book oriented because you've written children's books and you filled your house full of books, but do you see a big difference, again, anecdotally, as you just said, in how they are using and engaging all different ways of acquiring stories? Because I think that's part of the question is, do people still have a thirst for story? And you were arguing that you look, there's people that are have a hunger for story through Netflix or other things. What do you think about that?
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I love the way that you're focusing on that question of the hunger for story. I raised, I'd say three-fifths of my kids are intense, serious readers. The other two-fifths are not. I have, you mentioned the picture of me in the bathtub brushing my teeth, incidentally, and reading at the age of eight. That's what I was doing. I have a picture of my daughter, who is now in her 30s, walking. I caught her walking home from school, nose in a book. It was probably Harry Potter, I'm going to guess, unable to put it down. But and so I have seen a lot of engagement with stories in print, but I would argue, and this is one of the things I argued in my post on this, is that you're right. There is a hunger for story, and people are feeding it. They have been feeding it, first of all, through television more and more, and not just since the advent of quote prestige TV, and streaming and all of that kind of thing. And people were watching. Their stories, whether they be soap operas. A lot of our older, maybe grandmothers used to call soap opera my story, right? Even just episodic television, film, movies. And I think that has just deepened really with the advent of streaming and the advent of a form of television narrative that is more like a book. It's like if you watch a six episode Netflix or HBO Max series on a particular topic, it may well be based on a book, and it has a beginning, middle, and end, right? And it fulfills that need. And I would argue, again, talking about the younger generation, a huge part of this hunger for story is met through video games. And it's just something that maybe we don't want to think about. And those of us, you know, maybe if you don't have like a deep knowledge of video games, you just think, oh, she's talking about Pac-Man, or she's talking about Mario or whatever. No, there's a whole genre. And this is one of my youngest son, actually, who's 21. And incidentally, just graduated from a great books program, wrote his thesis on Nietzsche, and is very, very smart and very brainy. He is very much into video games, and he's into it because of the story. Because in a video game, it's not only you're not only immersed in a story, you're kind of in that kind of video game, you're a co-creator in the story as well. And so I think, yeah, the hunger is there, and people are indeed kind of satisfying it through visual narrative in visual ways. Now, I personally think books are better. I mean, I think
me too.
Yeah. I mean, I think books obviously engage more of us. I mean, they are even, you know, they demand more of us, and that's always a good thing. That always brings us more and helps us grow more than simple, just, you know, passive entertainment. But I do think, you know, the story is not dead. And, you know, just one more quick example. My older grandson is 12, and I just took him on a trip. We went on a little adventure, grandmother adventure. We went through the South, and they live in a southern state, and so do I. So we did a little trip through the Southeast and up to visit his aunt, my daughter, up in Kentucky and back and through the mountains. And he was reading on his Kindle. He has a Kindle, and he prefers to read from that, which is his, you know, he's a screen child. And unfortunately, you know, his school, which I think is pretty good, but it's still a Chromebook school, unfortunately. And so that's kind of what he's comfortable with. But he was reading books, and he was reading a series called Spy School, which one of my kids really enjoyed a lot at that age. And it was interesting to me because he was pretty immersed in it. He finished one book, he clicked, and he went on and started the next one. He said, I just want to see what happens. And so it's there. Again, I do read on screens. I'm not a fan of it. I definitely know that my own retention is better with print, better on a page, reading from a page. But he's reading, and his school encourages reading, and they read actual books, not just excerpts. And so on. So I think there's pockets, and again, it's all anecdotal. I think there's reason for concern, but I also think there's reason for hope.
You mentioned Harry Potter, and you write in your piece, your response to the Atlantic piece about Harry Potter, and you kind of defend Harry Potter against the naysayers. And, you know, certainly my experience with my kids as they read that Harry Potter was kind of like a gateway drug for them into what you call bulk reading, where it just like develops the kind of exercise and habit of reading and being into a book and a great story. But what define bulk reading, and why is that something that we shouldn't be so worried about when it includes even more lowbrow stuff, kind of like what you just talked about, stories?
In my experience, all my kids went through that. And I did too as a child. You know, with them, so for example, you know, my second oldest son, who's now in his early 40s, was a pretty early reader, but then kind of stopped a little bit. Had, you know, there's always like developmental kind of issues where they're, you know, their ability to read is not caught up with their interests, you know, and so it's like they don't want to read baby books anymore, but they don't have the ability to kind of read a more mature theme. But his gateway, his bulk reading was Goosebumps, the Goosebumps, and he just devoured the Goosebumps series, which are stupid, right? And, you know, kind of very predictable, kind of not bad trashy, but just superficial. But he loved, and he became, you know, it didn't hurt him. As you said, it developed that habit, not just the habit of reading and developing the skills, but the habit of kind of associating reading with a good time.
Yeah.
Right? With pleasure. and with enjoyment and with kind of a lot of maybe ancillary things like agency and privacy and being by yourself and being able to do something independently and engaging with something independently. And so I absolutely defend bulk reading, even for adults. I mean, I do it. I mean, I don't think that somebody who's, you know, reading diet is all, what do they call it now? Romanticy and all of that kind of thing is, you know, maybe they can go further and challenge themselves a little more. But, you know, I read magazines, right? You know, magazines are my form of bulk reading. And again, it keeps me engaged. And I think that, I mean, I just think that any form of reading, engaging with words on a page or even on a screen to some extent, but words on a page is such an act, it's an active activity. It's like it engages the whole person, and I think it's irreplaceable. And I absolutely defend bulk reading, especially for kids. It just, as I said, it gets them in a habit and gets them to associate reading with fun.
Right. One of the things that's hard for me when I think about a Kindle is that I love the physicality of a book. I love having a pen in my hand or a pencil. I like underlining. I like full, you know, I like that three-dimensional experience. But I wanted to talk about what I thought was one of your best critiques obliquely of the Atlantic piece was that there's no mention of the Bible, which is the best-selling book of all time. And what you say is, you know, actually people are still reading. And the book that a lot of people are reading, that the author, she talks about Gutenberg's invention of the printing press, but she doesn't right. mention the Gutenberg Bible, which really right. started the whole nature of book reading for more than just, you know, the gentry. And and I know that Christian authors have complained for years that their books have been excluded from the New York Times bestseller list often, that they don't really count certain books. But do you feel that apps, Hallow, Formed, Word on Fire, that there's just been this kind of crush of Catholic publishing that is maybe reviving books in that whole world?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because this is a world, of course, I've been involved with for a number of decades now, I'll say. And so the first thing to say is that when we talk about the, you know, not the death of publishing, but the suffering pangs of publishing, which is something we've been talking about for a while, really since the advent of not only digital media, but also online sales, right? Amazon and so on, which have, on one sense, everybody hoped would help publishing, but seems to have definitely a mixed heritage in that respect, is that as book sales supposedly have decreased, the one area of publishing that has not is religious publishing, or in this country, Christian publishing. Both evangelical and Catholic, although Catholic publishing is nowhere near the level of quote Protestant or generic Christian publishing. And that's a part of the market that has either remained steady or grown. Okay. So I think that's something to note, something for people who are scared about the future of reading to note. But secondly, as you mentioned, when I was writing this blog post, it just popped into my head. I said, wait, there are people who are reading every day, and not just reading casually, but who are reading an ancient text, who are reading a complicated text. I mean, people who don't read the Bible think the Bible is simple. But once you start reading the Bible, you know it's not simple. It's mm-hmm. complex. It's nuanced. It's dark. It's confusing. And there are people, millions of people every day, tens of millions of people, who are engaging with this ancient, complicated text in a serious way. And not only in a serious way for study, but in a way that they are seeking to allow their lives to be shaped by this text. And so if we're going to talk about the, quote, death of reading and not take into account that actually there is a large population of people who are reading very seriously every day and never stopped, and in fact, who are being encouraged to read, and as you point out, whose numbers are probably growing. What you didn't mention was the Bible in a Day, right? Or Bible in a Year.
Oh, right, sure.
Program, right? Which is the, you know, for, I don't know if it still is, but for a couple of years, wasn't it the number one app?
Podcast, yeah.
Yeah, and number one podcast of encouraging people to read this text every day. So I just think it's an interesting little twist to the argument, which in the end probably isn't much of an argument anyway, because it is anecdotal, her argument. So I think it's something to take hope from, but it's also maybe, I'm always looking at these issues from kind of the perspective of evangelism and how we as the body of Christ, as the church, can kind of maybe plug into this, into the zeitgeist, and try to serve people and be more pastoral. And, you know, maybe this is something for us to take note of and to take hope from, is that, yeah, you want to talk about reading? We're still reading. Come read with us, right?
Well, I think our show just really, we diagnose issues in society, but we always like to give our readers a good takeaway at the end and a positive spin on how we go forward.
Yeah.
And on that note, you know, I think especially for parents, especially parents in my age category that are raising children and teens, they feel kind of overwhelmed. I mean, there's all these stories about how they're fighting the school districts just to get the laptops out. And mm-hmm. it just feels like a Sisyphean task to try to get their kids to read and to read, you know, yes, the bulk reading is great, but also to read quality literature, especially when everything's being annotated. I remember I had to fight to find just the classic, complete, unabridged Anne of Green Gables. The first thing that the bookstore owner gave me was the graphic novel version of it. Then there was the annotated version. Finally, we found the original version. But what are some practical things, I don't know, resources or lists? Like, what would your advice to be to young parents today in the current tech-heavy setting to get their kids reading, even something like Harry Potter?
Yeah, well, you have to read with them. I mean, you just have to. And you have to, before they can read, you have to read to them. And believe me, when I think about my many years of parenting, those are some of the most pleasant memories that I have. And I almost can't talk about it without being moved about those. You know, every night I read to them. Every night, up until they absolutely wouldn't have it anymore, which is, you know, maybe middle school. And they were guys, so, you know, it was probably around middle school. But I mean, and we read picture books, but then we eventually moved into reading, you know, more complicated things. I read, you know, we read Huckleberry Finn out loud. We read, you know, Tom Sawyer out loud. We read, once they got to that age, we read substantive books that took maybe weeks to read. And it was, again, like I talked about the bulk reading, about associating reading with pleasure. That's another way of doing it, is you associate reading with happy times, with closeness, with love. So that's the first thing, I think, is just, if you don't do anything else, read with and to your kids. And then as they get older, encourage them to read to you, right? Make it a joint thing, especially maybe if you're reading something like poetry. You know, take turns reading lines and all of that kind of thing. But the second thing is to be kind of assertive about curating their reading, to not just maybe set them loose in the library and say, pick something up, but to educate yourself. There's plenty of great lists online of books to read for various age groups. Have options. I was very, very directive with my kids. I would check out books for them. And I would say, you're going to read this. It was kind of a mix of they picked their own and then I found things. And usually, you know, they learned to trust me. I wasn't giving them horrible things. I was giving them fun, age-appropriate things, interesting things to read. So to be kind of involved in curating their reading, I think is very important. And then the third thing is to read yourself. It doesn't make any sense for us to be holding our phone and scrolling on our phone and barking at our kids to go read a book, you know, for us to actually be reading physical books and magazines and all that kind of thing. And to make it a family time to, I know one friend of mine, she's got older kids, but they do every summer, they do a mom and son's reading group. They pick out a novel to read together and discuss together. So there's all kinds of things you can do, but the like anything in parenting, it all begins with not talking about things, but doing them. And as I said, it's a very bears nothing but good fruit. It really does bear nothing but good fruit.
During the summer, Ashley, when we would go on vacation, we would often have books on tape in our car. Well, I call it books on tape, but I think that's a really, really big one. And it speaks to something that you wrote, Amy, which was to be able to read and enjoy a book without illustrations became a mysterious but persistent goal. And when they listen to books aloud, they have to create the characters or the scenes in their imagination. But I think that that's a really terrific compromise between a screen and a book where they learn to listen and to use their imaginations about books.
Yeah, absolutely. And even especially I would say when you're talking about things like fairy tales and maybe even retelling of Shakespeare's plays and all of that kind of thing, poetry, to have, classy British accents and fun accents and actual actors reading all of that kind of thing. It's like radio. It's a really good idea. I agree with that.
Well, we just have a little bit of time left, but I would love to know what are some of the things that you're reading right now? What's your summer book list look like?
Well, I always curate my own summer book list or my book list from I do try to read a lot of contemporary literature, just because I do find treasures once in a while, but also I like to kind of see what is popular, what people like to read as an aspiring as a writer myself. But right now I am reading two things. I am reading Anna Karenina, which I air quote read in college during a because I took a class in Tolstoy, but somehow, shockingly for a 20-year-old college student, I procrastinated, and I think I read Anna Karenina in a matter of 2 days, 50 years ago, so it doesn't count. And something got in my head and said, "You should read Anna Karenina." So I'm reading Anna Karenina, and of course, I'm reading The Odyssey. I think I'd maybe read synopsis of it before, but never actually dug into it myself. So I'm reading a translation of The Odyssey. Those are the two main tasks for the next week or so.
You plan on going to the movie?
My youngest son and I are going to go. We won't hit it opening night, but we'll be going the second week it opens. I'm frankly skeptical of what I'm going to see, but I'm also interested, but skeptical. And that's part of the reason I want to make sure that I read and tried to understand the poem at a at a deeper level so I can engage with the film more intelligently.
Well, this is a worthwhile topic. We recently had Megan Cox Gurdon on to talk about a similar theme of the importance of reading. She had the same advice as you. She said, "Read out loud." That's her thing. But, read out loud as long as they will with you. And I agree. I just cherish the times reading out loud with my kids. But thank you for all of your wonderful insights. I think we're walking away feeling hopeful. And so for our listeners who would love to follow more of your work and writings, where can they find you?
Well, I have a very, very basic website at amywellborn.com, one L, no E at the end. But it's, as I said, it's very basic. I do most of my writing at my blog, which is called Charlotte Was Both. And if you're a reader, you know what that's an allusion to, which is the very end of Charlotte's Web, which was one of my favorite books as a child, which was it is not very often that someone who comes along who is both a good friend and a good writer, Charlotte Was Both. So you can look that up and I'll be there.
Beautiful. Well, thanks for your time today, Amy.
Thank you for having me. It was great.